We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to a very special afternoon special episode of Fusion Patrol.
Afternoon special?
It's an afternoon special. Just like when you'd come home from school on Wednesdays when you were a kid. An afternoon
special. You had the ABC afternoon specials. This is an afternoon
this
special.
Yes, I think it is. My name's Eugene.
My name is Ben.
And we're going to be talking about, we're going to be doing a one-off program today. We're going to be looking at the 2009 movie.
2007.
2007?
Yes.
2009, according to my notes. Well,
it's 2007.
The 2008 movie.
It's 2007, according to both Hulu and IMDb.
Huh. Well, late 2000s. Movie?
Yes, that much is certain.
Awkwardly titled Jerome Bixby's The Man from Earth. Professor John Oldman is leaving his job at the university and his life, uprooting to move on. Six faculty members and a student arrive for an impromptu farewell party. They are all concerned as to why this successful, popular man has suddenly decided to leave. Is he in trouble? He insists that he isn't, but something doesn't ring true. They press him until he decides to try an experiment. He tells them a tale. At first, he pretends it's for a science fiction novel he's writing, but later admits that it is his real life. He is 14,000 years old. He has never aged and never scars. He doesn't know how or why, but he has learned to move on every 10 years or so when people start to notice that he doesn't age. His colleagues, a biologist, an anthropologist, an archaeologist, an art historian, a history professor, and a psychiatrist, try to prove or disprove his story, but they cannot, as he continues to provide plausible but completely unprovable answers to all their questions. When it becomes clear that he is the basis for one of the most famous figures in history, some members of the group become increasingly upset at his story, and finally, he backs down, admitting it was all a joke that went too far. As the group disperses to go home, the last two to leave discover the truth about John Oldman. So interesting. We had a talk when we were recording last week about Death, Southern Dominion on Space 1999, which featured a group of immortal people, and we kind of went off on a tangent about Requiem for Methuselah and Star Trek and some ideas that writers have had about what immortality would be like for a human being. And that's what brought this one to my mind, because it is nothing but a discussion of the potential of what being immortal would be like. So, and I enjoy this film immensely. I even though it has no lasers, space battles, or even little robot sidekicks, nothing. But I immensely enjoyed this, largely because it kind of feels like an episode of Fusion Patrol. A bunch of people sitting around just yabbing, yammering, and yakking and talking. So anyway, that's why I brought that one out. And so what did you think of the film, Ben?
This is one of the best movies I've ever watched in my entire life.
Okay.
Pure and simple.
It really is.
when we watched it on Sunday, Keith and I, and when it was over, you know you're in for something good. For anybody who's ever watched a movie with me and Keith, whenever we watch a film, if we're really, really jazzed about what we're seeing, we find ourselves continually pausing the film and then talking about it. And we did this quite a few times during the course of this film. And when it was all over, we finally just looked at each other and said, I loved this movie. I absolutely loved this film. I thought it was brilliant. And this is an example of what outstanding science fiction can be. It doesn't have to be epic in scope. It can have an intimacy to it and explore all sorts of wonderful concepts. and discuss them as science fiction should. This movie was just brilliant, and even had a couple surprises for me too.
You know, I heard about this film a few years ago and was intrigued by it and wanted to. I didn't envision it for what it turned out to be. I mean, I kind of did, but, you know, I had a completely different idea in my head of how it would go. And it, when the family were off at camp this summer, I happened to find that it was on Hulu, and I'm like, whoa, here's my chance. I'm going to sit down and watch this. And I was absolutely blown away.
So you just saw it for the first time really recently then?
Yeah, in July. Yeah.
Okay.
For the first time. And
well, that's fine. I mean, last weekend was the first time I ever saw this film. And, you know, the sad part is that a lot of my sci-fi friends are kind of like, what, you never saw this film before? And I'm like, no.
Well, it was never released theatrically as far as I can tell.
No, this is, from DVD. What I can tell, this is an independent film.
Yep.
So, and independents are, you know, independent films are hard to track down. I mean, unless they hit film festival circuits and you're plugged into those, there's no way you're going to know about this. But wow.
Yeah. So a couple things. Jerome Bixby, in case that name is familiar to some of our listeners, Jerome Bixby has written several programs that you may know. So Star Trek fans, you're going to know Mirror, Mirror, Requiem for Methuselah, By Any Other Name, and Day of the Dove, were the four classic series episodes that he wrote. He wrote the very famous It's a Good Life Twilight Zone episode with Bill Mumy as the kid that really is really creepy.
He thinks people into the cornfield or whatever it is.
Yeah, and he also is the creator of the concept and co-writer for Fantastic Journey.
What?
Yeah. No, Asimov wrote the novelization based on Bixby's screenplay.
Holy crap, I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. So Jerome Bixby has been writing science fiction for a long time.
And well, that much I knew, but I had no idea he had anything to do with Fantastic Journey.
Yep, he did indeed. He was basically, it was his idea, sounds like.
NBC butchered it.
But,
we're not going to go back down that road, and I'm sorry, no.
Well, now I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Fantastic Journey, Fantastic Voyage. I'm talking about the submarine one in the body.
Oh, that's the Fantastic Voyage.
Voyage. Did I say Journey?
Yes.
See, my notes are so small I can't see it yet. Fantastic
Yeah, Fantastic Voyage. That was, okay, yeah, that's Asimov's story.
But Asimov actually wrote this novel based on
Bixby's book.
Yeah,
or Bixby's story.
Yeah,
interesting. I haven't seen Bixby Fantastic Voyage in a long time.
Bixby and I, you know, I saw that probably within the last 8 months. It's a lot better than I kind of remember it to be.
Oh well, Keith and I saw it a number of years ago. We have it on DVD, and it holds up very, very well. But I guess I just must have blanked out when I saw Jerome Bixby's name pop up on the credits, because I'd read the novel novelization that Asimov did years ago, back when I was in grade school. So it always stuck in my brain that this was an Asimov story. And so my bad.
Well, I mean, I thought so too. I thought so too. I was just, when I was going through the Jerome Bixby's biography, and it came up on that, it was, let me see who the other guy was. It is based on a story by Otto Clement and Jerome Bixby.
Interesting. And Asimov did the screenplay or novelization?
Novelization.
Fascinating.
Phantom Books obtained the rights for a paperback novelization based on the screenplay and approached Isaac Asimov to write it.
Wow.
But the novelization was released 6 months before the movie. Many people mistakenly believe the film was based on Asimov's book.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So,
but, oh, I will consider, okay, I consider myself corrected.
So, and, you know, Mirror, Mirror is without doubt one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. So a lot of stuff that Bixby has done, really, I've enjoyed.
You know, and the funny thing is you know, while I, you know, and you and I have had this conversation before when we really delved into Trek, third season episodes, generally not my favorite. And while Requiem for Methuselah, again, is not one of my favorite episodes, in terms of execution. As I've gotten older, I found the some of the ideas and the concepts that are that lay beneath the surface for that episode to be very profound.
Yeah. So I'm going to come back to Requiem for Methuselah after we've talked about this film a little bit, because I have a feeling that he wrote Requiem for Methuselah in 1969, mm-hmm. and this was written in, well, actually, in the 1990s. Late 1990s, because he died in 1998. This was dictated on his deathbed to his son.
I didn't know that. So
this is the last work that Jerome Bixby did. His son was a screenwriter, so he turned it into a movie, and then it has also been turned into a stage play since then, which I would love to see, because this thing this is a stage play.
It is a stage play because
it's economical.
That's the beautiful thing. It's minimalist.
They have
totally minimalist.
They have just all the pieces that they need in that room to convey the varying points of view and the varying ideas. And I'll tell you something, watch it a second time,
mm-hmm.
because you'll get some of it going through this, just talking about it here in the podcast, because I'm not going to be able to help it. But there are things, I was paying close attention the first time I watched it because I was wrapped in this tale he was weaving, just like mm-hmm. the audience was wrapped mm-hmm. in it. But watching it the second time, there are so many things that they say that are foreshadowing something that happens later that you don't. That, for example, there's a scene where the psychiatrist is talking to him, and he says, "Tell me about your father." And he says, "Well, I okay, don't really remember my father. It's an old guy or something like that." And he says, "Well, I guess that's something. I barely remember my
father. Mine." Uh-huh. Yes,
and it's like,
I did catch that.
If you don't. When you know at the end, the twist there, that's his father.
Right.
That spoilers, folks.
I know, but you're right. I thought about that. This is one of these movies. Some of the best movies are the ones that you take with you and you can't stop thinking about in all the good ways. I mean, obviously, you and I have both seen some garbage that we just cannot get out of our heads. They like burn into our brain. But there have been, this is one of these movies where I could not stop thinking about it. It had such an enormous impact on me. And, there were scenes that I kept replaying in my head, and that was one of them. The whole, do you remember your father or not? And Will, the psychiatrist, saying, I barely remember mine.
It's such a passing comment.
It is a passing comment, but it came back to me. Hours later, after I saw the film. So yeah, this is a perfectly constructed film. There are no flaws to it. This story is perfection.
Yeah, if viewers are listening, or our listeners are listening to this without having seen this film, definitely go find it.
Oh, you've got to see this movie. It's amazing.
I really, really can't recommend it.
Every single one of my Facebook friends who has seen this movie already has all said the same thing. One of the greatest stories that Jerome Bixby ever wrote.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about John Oldman. He is here. He's having a farewell party. Against his wishes, really. Some of the dialogue right at the beginning makes it sound like he just didn't even show up for his farewell party at the school. Because that, their first lines are, "Hey, what are you thinking? Where are you going?"
Buggering off without saying goodbye, like that, yeah.
And so they brought the party to him as he's packing up. And the first thing they spot is the art professor spots what looks like a Van Gogh.
Right.
And she's, looks at it and says, "Wow, that's it's a really good copy.
It's a Van Gogh.
It looks like a Van Gogh. It's a really good copy." And on the back, it's like, "To Jacques Bourne, my good friend." And she says, "It's, obviously if it's a fake, she doesn't think it's a real Van Gogh, but she says, "But it's contemporary to Van Gogh." Because, why would he have a real Van Gogh that nobody knows
right.
in his possession? So you just dismiss it. And of course it turns out it's real. Or he claims later on that it's real in the course of telling his story, which is, because I keep pressing him, why are you leaving? And of course, we've been given all this stuff even before he does it, because like the women are saying, you know, all of the girls down at the university wish they had your secret. You haven't aged a day.
Duh.
In 10 years. And so, I mean, this is the one thing about this script that makes me think it's, well, one of the many things that makes me think it's more of a stage play, is that there is nothing that doesn't get put on the table at some point during the course of this.
Everything is laid out.
It's all laid out. And some of it's a little ham-fisted, and some of it's a little subtle. But it's all – I mean, just like having all the people from the different departments, one each, down to talk to him. He doesn't happen to have two archaeologist friends. He's got one archaeologist and one anthropologist.
Right.
You know, and one biologist. And he was born 14,000 years ago. This is the story he starts to tell. He just stopped aging. He doesn't
at the age of 35, if I remember right?
I think he said approximately 35, because, you know, he probably wouldn't know anyway. He doesn't actually know. And this is one of the most fascinating things about this, is that he does not remember his life. And I really feel like this is the difference between Jerome Bixby writing this at 70, or whatever he was when he wrote this, and Jerome Bixby writing Requiem for Methuselah when he was 40.
Yes. Yes, you know, agreed.
I can feel the age of the man there.
Right.
We talked about a little bit briefly that last time that the kids at our summer camp fall into this. They would have these debates about at Socrates Cafe. They would have these debates about whether you'd want to live forever. And we had the kids who were like, "Yeah, I'm there." And we'd have the kids who are, "No, I wouldn't want that. I'd be bored. I'd be." It would be horrible. It would be worse than hell. And of course that comes from Twilight Zone episodes.
Well, it comes from the very notion that you remember everything.
Right. And life isn't like, you know, you get old, you realize it's like, there are things that pop up that I'll dig out of a drawer and I'm like, wow, I completely forgot that I ever did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it jogs when you see it, but it's just like, how did I forget?
Right,
that, you know, piece there, of my life.
There are two arguments that can be made here. I mean, one argument is that, you know, because John is the way that he is. I mean, he talks about you know, the cellular regeneration and all that. One argument could be made that, well, he should be remembering everything. He should be able to retain all of it. You know, but you know, be that as it may, I we talked a little bit about this last week. We had the Doctor Who series last season with that immortal little pipsqueak whose name I choose to forget.
I'm thinking they swiped that right from this.
It could be, because when the Doctor sees her, you know, years later, she has virtually no memory of her time when she was growing up with, you know, in that Viking village.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now she's in Renaissance England, and she has virtually no memory of that time. And, you know, and so if you start to take the way the human mind works today and project that onto someone who would have that unbelievably long lifespan, yeah, it then becomes believable that as you move on and as you start to gain new memories, older ones just start to get
pushed down,
archived.
Yep.
Not deleted, but archived into, you know, the really, really deep, dark recesses of the brain, so that they're no longer part of the immediate collective consciousness. I mean, you have to really think hard in order to bring them up.
Well, the thing is, I mean, modern neuroscience research into memory is that, you know, we have this thought that your mind is like a tape recorder, and that when it plays back, it's playing back what's been stored, but it's not actually what happens. What happens?
Not really.
It reconstructs a fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To
yes,
fit
it does.
What you thought happened. So you really don't actually know if what you remember truly correct. It's probably generally sort of right, but we know that you can actually, implant ideas in someone's head and alter their recall. Mm-hmm. They've done experiments on this. So it's, you know, the brain is a thing we do not understand.
Not entirely.
I hate to use that cliche, but we are, you know, we're working on it. And it doesn't remember everything. I mean, that's the gist of it here. And that is the premise that we go on with this,
yeah,
with this story.
I mean, you could have multiple points of view on the same same subject, the same event,
mm-hmm.
And they could be just as different as night and day, yet each one is completely truthful
to what
per that person's perspective.
Right. From the same person.
Yeah.
Different points in their life, remembering an event that happened differently than it did if it was on an actual recording device. So,
mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this guy is that, unlike some other stories, he never makes the claim to be immortal.
No.
He is, I recover from being sick. I don't scar up. But, again, referencing Requiem for Methuselah, the first thing he did is he fell in battle, but he did not die. Or if you look at Highlander, they kill him and then they can't.
They don't die.
They don't die. Here is a guy who just has not yet been hit by a truck or whatever it is. And he clearly is afraid of it. He even says it when he said, he breaks down and he says, I had the opportunity to sail with Christopher Columbus once. I mean, thought that the world was probably round, but just wasn't quite willing
quite
to risk
yet.
It.
No.
And that, you know, that's so, I don't want to die. I want to continue on living. There's more things that I can do. And,
you know, and that's the interesting concept. I mean, especially given this idea that it presents, where if new memories start taking the place of the oldest memories, if that is indeed the process.
Or strong memories take the place of weak.
Strong memories. I mean, whatever. Yeah, exactly. But if that is indeed the case, then this jaundiced point of view that 60s science fiction had posed, you know, like Star Trek or Twilight Zone, may not indeed come to pass. I mean, it, you know, if we're going to take this is what happens to the human consciousness, then it presents a more positive spin on what, you know, I'll say it, immortality could possibly present.
Yeah. Now the psychiatrist does ask him, "Have you ever wanted it to end?" And he's like, "Nope." Do you fear death? Yes. Who wouldn't? You know, he does his thing. But here's my thought. This is my profound moment at age 50, at 51, and from sight of seeing older people like my father. I think that as a human being, when you write this story, when you write a story, you cannot divorce it from your own experience. And so if you were to write a story about immortality, you would have to be pretty good to divorce it from the fact that at your age and at my age, we can't do everything we could do at 35.
Right.
And I know this, you know, when my father was 82, he was, technically speaking, still quite active and still quite alert.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was mentally competent. He wasn't disabled, but what he was he'd had hernia operations, and so he could not stand for long periods of time. Couldn't ride a bicycle. I mean, so he had his things like hiking, riding bicycles, and standing around and shooting pool. He loved doing, he could do that for hours and hours on end, but he physically couldn't do it anymore because of the hernias. He loved driving, but he couldn't because he'd had cataracts, and so he couldn't drive at night, even at, you know, after the surgery. Mm-hmm. And he had high blood pressure, or he had a heart condition, but, you know, it was treatable, but he couldn't drink beer, which he loved to do, and he couldn't go even stay up in the mountains at high altitudes because of the heart condition, which here in Arizona, you got to get up to the high altitudes to not be miserable. And so whereas he was not, he wasn't handicapped, he was bored. He was just,
because of physical limitations. Bored
because he could not do the things that he loved to do.
He had physical limitations.
But if he had the body of a 35-year-old, would he be bored at age 82? People say, I'm so old at 82, I don't want to go on anymore. But if I felt like I was 35, I don't know why I wouldn't.
And this is an idea that I actually support. I mean, I firmly believe, I remember I quoted Babylon 5 when we talked about this. There's one character who is one of the oldest creatures in all of the universe.
Oh, and you're talking about Lorien. I'm talking about
Lorien. Yes. All right, yes. Yeah. And he talks about how in order to appreciate life, it has to be short. And on one aspect, I could see that if you are able to retain everything and bring it back to your instant, and just bring it right back up in your memory. Yeah, I could see that. I could see how that would change you. But I have also, and it's funny how internally I have always believed that even if you lived for thousands and thousands of years, that because the universe is, and the world is always changing, that there's always something new, that life, if you had the ability, and you were not faced with physical disability of any sort or any kind of physical limitation like our character John is in this film, then life would continue to present you with new challenges because there's always something new down the road. And therefore, you would not be bored. So in that aspect, from that point of view, I could completely accept John's statement about how, no, he doesn't want to die, and if I were in his position, I wouldn't either. Because the world is unfolding. He's had all this history and, things that he's seen in the past, but heavens, think about the things that he's going to see in the future.
Like Mars, which he specifically mentions. One of the other aspects that people put in as being the overwhelming weight of immortality is the grief, the passing of everyone and everything you've ever known. Now, obviously, everyone in their lifetime experiences loss of people they know, family, loved ones. It's part of life, and it's a terrible thing, and we all suffer it at one level or another. But it is also a truism that it fades.
Grief
fades in time.
You learn to live. Well, that's something for psychologists to discuss. But I would say that you learn to live with it.
Yes, some people perhaps, but do you suddenly, after the loss
I don't
of
feel
someone
the same.
Close, you don't just suddenly well up and start uncontrollably weeping anymore.
Not over my dad. No,
dead
I don't feel
20
that.
Years or
No. I mean, Keith and I had this conversation a little bit earlier today. I mean, we had a cat that we absolutely adored, and he was only 14 months old. We had to put him down. That was over a month ago. We're still very, very visibly upset about that. But if I think back to like my dad, who and I loved him fiercely, I can think about him and I don't feel anguish. I don't feel sadness. And when I do think about him, I think nothing but good now.
Yeah,
I have nothing but good feelings. So yeah, that happens. That's part of the human psychological process.
So John has this long life. So that whole. Your grief was going to carry with you. Highlander is a good example of that, where finally you just get to the point where I'm just not going to get close to anybody because they're just going to die.
Yeah, they're going to die. It's not a good thing. Right? Yeah,
it's not the human way. We get close to people. And especially if you were still 35, physiologically go on, and you're going to maybe not forget them, but. And I don't even want to suggest this, but I can tell you that part of what you just said caught to my mind because I was looking through some stuff the other day and I'm like, whoa, I remember that cat, but I'd completely forgotten they existed.
Mm-hmm.
25 years ago, I'd forgotten all about it. I have some pets that I remember throughout my life, and then I have some that I cannot remember unless I see a picture and then go, oh, yeah, whatever happened to that dog or cat or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, right. You know, I think grief is not going to come. This is one that's just going to make you talk about immortality and death and memory and loss. That's the whole point of it. Let's try to talk a couple of the ideas that we get pulled out here during the course of the episode, well, the movie. One of the things that sets us off is the stone axe.
Yes.
That the anthropologist pulls out and he says, wow, this is an amazing specimen of a stone axe. And he goes, yeah, I got it at a thrift shop for 25 cents, whatever it was, 75 cents. And they take that for face value until he starts telling this story about being 14,000 years old. And then suddenly it's like, am I holding an artifact here? And his argument is so perfect. It's like, yeah, here's a ballpoint pen. If it turned out tomorrow that you lived to be 1,000, would you still have that pen? Of course not, because it would never occur to you. It would never occur to you to hang on to something like that. It's like, why would you do that?
Yes, exactly. So there's a bit of a joke there. You know, and then he confirms, I did get that axe at a thrift shop.
I really did get it at a thrift shop, I promise. But, you know, but it is the sort of thing where you might go into a store and see something. Oh, I had one of those yo-yos that was like that when I was a kid, and buy it for the nostalgia of it.
Yeah.
Which is what I think's happened here. He sees this in a store and he's like, wow, I'm going to just take that. Because he's, you know, obviously not really emotionally attached to it. He gives it
no, but he but now I would say, you know, in the case of John, he goes to the thrift shop and he sees it and recognizes it for what he is, you know, for what it is. And, you know, I would dare say that a number of people probably took a look at that, you know, thought it's just a rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not outside the realms of possibility. You know, I know people that collect a lot of antiquities, and when they do so, you know, they get them at dirt cheap because lay people, you know, they take a look at it and think, oh, it's just a nothing. You know, they are not trained to recognize the inherent value that's there. And, you know, John, obviously, because of his long life, does. So it makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm. But it also makes perfect sense that you just simply wouldn't be carrying that stuff through. And we even
I wouldn't.
We even see this. He's packing his truck. Here's that economy of the story. He's packing his stuff. He's donating all of his possessions, his furniture and everything at the house.
He sees no need to keep it.
No need to carry it. He's got just a few things like the Van Gogh. But that's not a pen or an axe or a tool that you had that you're like, oh yeah, I want to keep that. That's genuinely sentimental value.
Well, because it was a gift.
It was a gift to him from a good friend.
Right. And, so naturally he'll hold on to that. But all these other items, like you said, the pen, I mean, you know, that's something he just picked up, you know.
The sofa.
Well, the sofa, you know, yeah. The sofa he probably bought at a secondhand store. The pen he probably picked up because he was faculty at the university. And, you know, I was like, just
whatever.
A pen.
Yeah.
It's just a pen.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Caveman was just like, this is just my flint rocker.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So we have the people there in the room. I mentioned them. We have Dan, who's the anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be kind of in the...
Well, he's got an open mind,
plausible,
we'll say.
Yes.
He has an open mind. He's willing to entertain the possibility. He's not willing to dismiss it because, if I'm not mistaken, he's the one. He's the only one who says, we cannot prove it, but we cannot disprove it
either. Which, you know, at one point, Will, the psychiatrist, brings up an interesting point because he pulls a gun on him and threatens to kill him. And we get more of this, you can't prove it or disprove it. So I didn't say I couldn't die.
Right.
If you shoot me in the head or you shoot me in the heart, I could die. That will never prove to you I was immortal or that I was 14,000 years old. That just proves you were able to kill me. And you'll spend the rest of your life in prison wondering what happened, you know, whether it was true. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. He doesn't scar, or he claims he doesn't scar, so they can't find any... they can't find any wounds or anything like that on him. And I guess one thing that they could do to prove his story is not true is if he had a scar on him somewhere.
Right.
It wouldn't prove the story per se, but it would prove that statement was a lie. We have Harry, the biologist, who has a voice so annoyingly like Mr. Neelix on Voyager that you'd almost think it was the same actor.
It's not.
And
it's not the same actor, no.
It's not the same actor?
No. Neelix was played by Ethan Phillips. This was on John Billingsley, who played Dr. Phlox in Star Trek Enterprise.
They might as well be the same character. They're both the annoying alien with a terrible voice. Okay, you're right. You're right. I was thinking of him, but yes. Yes. But he's definitely one of the Star Trek aliens that was annoying
yes.
and he's stupid. But he plays okay here. He's a bit of a joker. He's
annoying at times, but then there are other moments where he seems...
He's annoying, but he's insightful.
Yes. Agreed.
He's insightful. And I love his line after John after John reveals that he's Jesus. He says, well, here's one prophecy coming through. You've returned.
Yeah.
I did not catch that the first time through. I have to admit when I was watching that. And then the second time I realized, oh, yeah, okay, got it. Got that one. He also is – everyone here is presenting a different facet. So now he's the family guy who's – is Jewish, his wife is a Muslim, his daughter is a Scientologist, and his son is an atheist.
Right.
So he is representing religious tolerance.
Yes.
And, you know, get along and do whatever. Although, you know, I would argue that Scientology is, you know. But back in the 1990s, that was probably a big deal in Hollywood. So of course, he'd love John to come down to the lab, but John rightly says, I don't want to go in there
and become a lab rat.
Not come out for 100 years. Is he 100 or 1,000 years or whatever it was? Yeah, I don't blame him there. We have
Edith.
Art.
Oh, okay, Art.
Art, which is, of course, the greatest American hero himself.
William Catt.
And his inappropriate... girlfriend, the student.
Ooh, I know. Yeah, that was uncomfortable.
But again, everything in this film is economical.
It's plausible. And yeah, well, and very, very economical.
I think it's there to tell us something. I think that there's supposed to be a commentary. Well, one, they needed somebody young because she is probably the most willing to accept his story, I think, of the bunch. I think she's take it. But also, we're talking about basically a May-December romance there between the professor and the girl, which is anything John ever does will be that way with a woman. So I think there's probably something there, but I just didn't quite
I didn't get
quite
that,
able to pull what the author was trying to say. But I you know, everything else is just so compact that it's there for a reason, but I just can't quite draw it out.
I can't draw on her. Now, there's another younger woman in there, in that crowd. That's Sandy.
Sandy, and she is the one who is in love with him. And
she's one, but she's the one who also seems to be the most willing. I mean, I got the feeling she was the one who was most willing to listen and accept everything that he said.
She loves him.
That's true.
So,
but maybe her reason for wanting to believe him isn't entirely altruistic.
Right.
There's a motive there, an emotional motive that is coloring her judgment, as opposed to the student, and that is the character of Linda.
Oh, and of course, Art, Art is the archaeologist, is not particularly believing of this because he throws stuff at John. And John gives him answers, and he says, well, you could have gotten that out of a textbook. He says, I did get it out of a textbook. So I didn't, you know, I'm born somewhere in a field near some mountains where it was cold.
But it's the textbooks that told me where it was I was born.
Yeah, I had to figure it out later on after we actually knew about these things.
And it made perfect sense. But they even acknowledge that. Even at some point, Art has to say, well, you've got an answer for everything. And he's not saying that as in... as a means of skepticism, although Art is the worst skeptic of the bunch. At least that was my perception.
Reasonable skeptics, of the reasonable
skeptics. Of the reasonable skeptics, he was the worst. But even he at one point does say, you have an answer for everything. I kind of got the feeling that he was sort of implying that I can't trip you up.
Right. And I think all of, like I say, it's as if Jerome Bixby has been thinking about this story
yes,
for a long time.
Absolutely. He's been, and each of these characters is a voice in his own head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as he's argued it back and forth, you know, he's looked at it from the archaeological standpoint, and he's argued from that perspective. He's looked at it from the religious literist, you know, the Christian literist point of view, and he's argued it from that standpoint, you know, and all the other different standpoints as he's worked out this story. You know, John, in a way, you could say, you know, had John been lying, then John would be Jerome Bixby himself.
Hmm. Now, and of course, then there's Edith, the art professor,
yeah.
And Christian literist.
She's the Christian literist, yes.
And she is the most offended.
Oh, totally offended.
She was offended before he even revealed that he was accidentally Jesus. It's like, and even there he has a very good command when he explains, it's like, he met the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's, we're establishing in this timeline, you know, he learned from the Buddha. There were some really good stuff. And then when he went to the Middle East, he tried to teach those things back again. And there are a lot of similarities.
Yeah, there are.
The things. And it's so self-effacing. It's like when they ask him, well, what did you say at the Sermon on the Mount? And he's like, well, which version?
Which one?
And he rattles off the Bibles. And they're like, yeah, okay. And he says, what happened is I was on a hill one day and I was doing some teaching and not many people stayed. It's like, but he doesn't remember what he said. You know, it's.
But there's a lot of,
you know, I know the type of things I was saying. You're right.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that. You know, when someone, I think another one of the characters said, you know, what did you trying to trick him up in terms of his memory. And he says, do you remember this, you know, on this particular date? And they kind of went, no. And he went, well, there you are.
They said something like, do you remember where you were in 1792? And he said,
12. Actually, it was 1292.
It might have been 1292.
It was 1292. And that was that was asked by Linda. She says, where were you 1292? And he went, where were you, a year ago today?
A year ago this day, yeah.
And she's like, don't know. He says, neither do I.
See, there you go. That's the point. Yeah, I have. I actually had that written down, but I have a 70. It doesn't really matter. It was a long time ago. Why would
it's
you
a long
remember?
Time ago, yeah.
It was a long time ago. So he, you know, he explains how he was trying to do his teaching, and he never said he was a son of God. He never said he was this. He just said, I had a master, referring to Buddha, who taught me these things and be nice to each other. And then he got in trouble with the Romans and they crucified him. So that's true.
Mm-hmm.
They don't nail him up. They tied him.
Which is actually accurate.
That's right. He claims to have used his Buddhist teachings to slow his metabolism down. And so they buried him because they thought he was dead. And then he tried to sneak away and he failed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And such the legend began. And he explained how his name got butchered through time and became what it is. And he said, I've been able to sit here and watch this not my whole life, but I've been able to watch this ever since then, mutating and changing and being used for good and for ill. And, what an amazing experiment. It's like an incredible game of Chinese whispers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
through there. And of course, Edith, who...
it destroyed her.
It destroyed her. And I know you're not a literalist.
No, I'm not.
I have trouble understanding Christian literalists because for exactly the reasons that they point out in this story. It's like, well, you know, so if the Bible's an inerrant word of God, then which version
of the Bible? Which I've never believed. I have never believed that the Bible is the inerrant word of God. But see, a lot of people of faith, and Edith is that, she is the person who represents that. She is the model that says when you challenge a person's faith, when it is so built upon this very particular foundation of a pure literalism, it is such a weak foundation.
Mm-hmm.
That the moment anybody comes along and says anything to the contrary, they completely crumble.
And
we see that with her.
They hammered her pretty hard there a couple
times. Yeah,
points.
They did.
Like, which version? He said, well, it's the King James Version. And it's like, well, but why didn't they get it right the first time? He said, I believe that God's hand continues to help man revise it to be more accurate. Why couldn't they get it right in the first place? Why couldn't they get man right in the first place? Why couldn't he? You know, I mean, they jumped on her.
You know, but that's the weird thing about it, is that she may have had a little retort for anybody who jumped on her in trying to help open up in her mind. But who was the one she was mad at? She was continually mad at John.
She's mad at John.
She wasn't mad at anybody else.
And she said something very interesting. She said, why are you mad? And she says, I'm mad because somebody I loved has disappeared. She's referring to the fact
to John.
The guy, yeah, she's referring to John, the guy she knew, is no longer that guy. And she loved that guy, but now there's a new one she doesn't like.
You know, and that's a frame of mind which really goes hand in hand with these people that are such Christian literalists. I don't want to sidetrack too much, but I've known of Christian literalist families that have had a child, during their teenage years, come out and say, Mom, Dad, I'm gay. You know, and then those parents say, I don't know you anymore. Hey, here's a news alert. You still know that person. That person hasn't changed. The only difference is you now know something new that you did not know before. And that's the same thing with Edith.
That's exactly
she
what
now
said.
Knows something new about John, or at least is aware of something new about John that she was not aware before. So for her to say, I don't know you anymore, tells, that's an example of the enormously closed mind that she has, and now how she has completely built her life on this extremely delicate house of cards.
And it's fascinating how when John finally backs down and says, yep, it was.
Then she's okay. She's mad at him.
Then she's like, well, I'm mad at you for doing this to us, but I'm a good Christian.
I still love you.
I'll forgive you.
It's like, oh, wow.
Oh, that was
Did that
really,
burn you? Like, it burned me. I was annoyed.
It didn't burn me. It amused me. But well, that's it, from it, a different it, standpoint,
it,
right?
It pissed me off.
Well, and you should. As a Christian, that was a pretty, she's demonstrating what a fickle and shallow thing her Christianity is.
Exactly.
To me, as an atheist, I looked at it and I was like, well, there you go. But, yes, it's when she says that, as a good Christian, I'll forgive you. I'm like, oh,
really? You know, and to me, that is just pure. That is so disingenuous. You know, and the weird thing is, Keith and I are of the same mindset in terms of our personal Christian beliefs. And as we heard everything that John was spilling out, to be honest, I found not one thing offensive. In fact, Keith and I were going, yep, yep, yep. Yep, with every single point that John was making.
Well, not to sidetrack it, but we know that what is recorded in the Bible with
Jesus'
Jesus's teachings are completely and utterly at odd with what many of the followers ascribe to what they do.
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
totally. I agree completely.
You know, and they are far more like Buddhist teachings than they are. The capitalist, conservative, Republican teachings, which is who have co-opted that movement a lot. So,
to draw a parallel to that, one of the things that, this is just my own personal conclusion, and John only touches on it really, really briefly when the question of the 12 apostles comes up, and then he starts to kind of clarify a little bit, they really weren't apostles. Peter, he was a better fisherman. He kind of like really dispels the whole apostleship movement that has been so perpetuated in conservative Christianity. And by the time we got to the end of this movie, I got the feeling that it was sort of a repeating of history, that John was sharing all of this, not necessarily to convince each of these people what he was saying was true, but maybe to open their minds up a little bit so that they would turn their own lives into a more constructive, positive direction. Because their minds have been expanded just a little bit.
Was this another Last Supper then?
In a sense, yes.
That's actually a fair. That's a fair. Okay, let's talk about Will, the psychiatrist, for a little bit. He comes in late because he's called in. Something was delaying him. He seems to be a little. I can't tell exactly. He seems offended by it. But well, at the same time, he's like, you're not insane, and yet what you're saying is insane.
It's totally insane. And he's really weird because there are moments where he seems really engaged in everything that John is saying. Yeah, at one point he leaves and he comes back. He wants to hear more, and then he literally shines a light on the entire thing and says, "This has to stop." Is like, you know, so I found him to be the most bizarre character of them all because he's the one that's the most inconsistent.
Remembering, though, that his wife died the day before.
Yes.
So he comes in. He's already distraught. Presumably that gun he had in his pocket was for himself.
Presumably, although we learn that it's empty.
We learn that it's empty, but that doesn't mean he didn't have bullets somewhere else, like in the True. Car or something. I mean, he had a gun in his pocket for some reason. And he's very distraught over the death of his wife. And he's an elderly gentleman. So, I mean, he's not, you know, he's not decrepit or anything like that. But he's the oldest person in the room, minus Mr. Oldman. And, you know, when he storms out after having threatened him and say, "I can't put up with this." And they say, "Well, his wife died yesterday." John rushes out because he wants to stop him from killing himself. It's clearly what he's doing.
Yeah.
Give me the gun.
But although in retrospect, I mean, once you get to the end of the film, you then realize that it's more than just John caring about a colleague.
Right, right. It is. He's very. But I think it wouldn't have mattered if it had been any other person in that.
No, it wouldn't.
It would have been exactly the same.
True, but I think. There, but right. In retrospect, when you look back on the film, because I think anybody who watches this movie, even if you know, cause I haven't had a chance to see it a second time.
Right.
But even for those people that do. Once they get to that moment, they're going to look at that with fresh eyes and say, you know, and realize that there's it's more nuanced than you might glean from the first viewing.
That's right. There's these little nuances that don't quite string until at the end. I mean, it works perfectly on first viewing.
It's even more resonant the second time through.
When he does come back and he apologizes, but again, there's an almost an antagonism against him, and I think that's because his wife is dead. He's seeing Oldman as being an insult to that. It's maybe not the right word, but he throws stuff at him a few times. It's like, "Will you ever feel guilty about the fact that you outlive these people? Earlier in the film, John points out that sometimes they ran him out of his tribe. Because they thought he was stealing their youth.
He was a bit of a vampire.
And then that was like, wow, vampire myth. Maybe this is where it comes from. Oddly enough, Will, says the same thing. He was not there when he made that revelation about the vampire thing. He calls him a vampire. Are you? Do you know? Maybe you are sucking the life out of the people. Maybe that's how you live. And of course, we don't know one way or the other.
That's distraught, Will.
That's distraught. But there's a fantastic line. Are you a vampire in the graveyard you helped fill? You know,
that's a pretty harsh line for someone that has been brought in by Art to be the more than just the skeptic, but the one to try and create a reality check on all of this.
So there's that. We did briefly mention that he's looking forward to going to Mars someday. You know, gosh, wouldn't that be amazing to be able to stand out there on a planet and look out at an alien sky? And here's a man who could do it.
Yeah, you know, especially when he compares it to how he still enjoys just kind of squatting, you know, and just staring up at the night sky on Earth. And that's something that I think a lot of, you know, a lot of ancient man, especially as they were, you know, growing into sentience and becoming aware of their surroundings, and, you know, that whole self-awareness and understanding of who they are and the world around them, you know, a lot of them, you always look up to the night sky because, you know, here's this blackness that is just peppered with all these points of light. And to somebody of a really humble mind, you can't help but feel some kind of sense of being overwhelmed by all of that. So then to move that forward and to hear John say, you know, or John talk about to be on Mars, it's just a further evolution of that idea.
So what could we do if we didn't die?
If we don't destroy ourselves, yeah.
You know, it's a... So he's just got time. He's not super... We want to make very clear, he's not superhuman.
No.
And this is one of the things that I think really contrasts this to the original Requiem for Methuselah, which is Flint is
Flint was
the most... He's Da Vinci. He's Brahms.
Yeah.
He's
Pollock, I think. Yeah, the whole number of people.
That posits that the mind continues and improves and you get better and more sophisticated with time. And I always... Well, first off, I found that a little problematic because it's wouldn't it just be the same guy continuing on instead of a different kind of, you know, Brahms versus Da Vinci? They're two different. But anyway, you know, that is the conceit of that episode, that the man just keeps accumulating knowledge. And he's smarter and thing. And here we have the thing where the guy says, I have like 10 degrees, I think he said.
Something like that, yeah.
In fact, I have all of your degrees, one of each of all of your degrees, except for the psychiatrist's. I don't have Will's degree there. But, you know, and they're like, oh, well, he says, but it's not any good. My biology degree is from Oxford in 1840.
It's useless.
It's out of date.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out of date. I can only have the only thing I've got is time. And they ask him questions about, well, what happened here? And he says, no, just me. You know, I was just in France at that time. I know what happened to me in France, not what was happening elsewhere in the world, except for what I read in the history books. They spend a lot of time making sure that you understand. And this funny thing, again, with that economical thing, there's a line that they throw out that he does not respond to, where Harry says, you know, he says, well, I've got some money. And he says, what'd you do, buy AT&T when it was only a dollar a share or something like that? And he doesn't respond to it. But obviously the answer is, how would I know? You know, you don't. You're not from the future going back in time and going, oh, I should have bought AT&T.
No, it's not like
I should have bought Apple stock or something like that.
He has no concept as to what's going to be successful or what isn't.
And any more than anybody else. I mean, yeah, maybe he does have AT&T stock, just like people who just happened to buy AT&T stock.
Maybe he did, and maybe he's independently wealthy, but it's not because he had any glimpse into the future. It's because he simply got lucky.
Right. So there's that. Now, one other piece, which is one of the more fascinating ones. In 1600, I think it was. Yeah, in 1600, I met someone who might be like me.
Right.
And we talked for a few days, and everything he said jived. But I know I was legit, but I had no way to prove
he was.
Had no way to prove me. And was he just parroting what I said, or did he think I was just parroting what he said? We parted and said we'd keep in touch. I never saw him again. But 200 years ago, I might have seen him on a platform, on a train platform, but I couldn't catch him.
He got away.
If they'd met and then never met again, that story wouldn't be as realistic. But he said, I thought I saw somebody who might be him. Did he see him? Or did he just
We'll never know.
Unless he bumps into him again someday. But
you know, but I love the idea of us never knowing.
Right.
I like that.
I wonder if that guy's name was Flint.
No.
And but yeah, he's in a way he's gonna have as many questions about him as we do.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know? And he can't just there's nowhere to get answers.
Right.
So in the end, Will forces him to back down. He said, you know, I can call up the guy with the rubber suits, rubber room, yeah, and white jackets, you know, and I can haul you off right now for your own protection.
This is one of the
stand down.
Yeah, this is one of the moments that actually kind of irked me a bit, because Will presents that option. He says, you know, you either present closure to all of these people or I have you committed. That was the option. So Will, I mean, John is silent for a moment and then he says, end of the line.
Yep.
This is it. And everybody's like, what? And I kept thinking, did you just not hear what Will said? Will offered him a really bad ultimatum that, you know, that John could either continue on with this, you know, and continue telling the truth as to who he is at the risk of being committed. And that's not something John wanted. Obviously, he wanted to get away. Mm-hmm. The only way he knew how to get away at that point, he was presented only two options, and only one of them was viable. And that kind of it was everybody else's reaction that kind of frosted me a bit.
Do you think maybe that Will was – I don't know whether he was – I don't think that he was convinced at that point. But
no, I don't believe that he was convinced at all.
Maybe he was more concerned about the other people in the room being able to clutch onto something because basically their world has been flipped upside down here. And so – you know, they know. I mean, they heard the ultimatum. It's like, okay, you either tell us that this is a lie or I have you committed to an insane asylum. And he says, okay, it's a lie. I wouldn't have believed him. I'd have, you know. But if I was Edith, for example, in particular, then that would be the opportunity for me to just go, okay, that's what I needed to hear.
And that's what Edith did, essentially. But you look at, like, what Dan, how he responded. I mean, he's like you.
He's crying. So
he's upset because I kind of got the feeling that Dan wanted to believe that all of this was true.
Oh, absolutely he did. Absolutely.
He wanted this to be true, and now he's upset. And it was his reaction that kind of really set me off. And I'm thinking, did you not hear what Will said? And did you not understand why John is responding the way that he did? You know, that, to me, that was a bit of a disservice to that character.
Art gets mad, really mad.
Oh, he gets furious.
Furious. Harry, I think Harry believed it. I think Harry was the one who walked out of there going, I think that was possibly true. I don't think he was upset.
I know. I agree. And I also maintain that I think even though Dan reacted really, really badly, I have a sinking feeling that if we were to see a sequel 10 years down the road, that
they filmed one. But anyway, go
they
ahead.
Did. I know it. Yes. Holocene, I think, is what it's called.
Anyway,
but that Dan would if he were approached 10 years later, he would be willing to concede the possibility that it was true.
And there's another – I'll add another piece to that equation in a moment. You know, Sandy has earlier staked her claim on John outside saying, you know, I love you. And he says, well, I'm very fond of you.
You're attractive.
Attractive, but, you know, considering what I've told you, I think you understand. And she's very philosophical. Well, how many years do people get? And my parents got divorced after 3 months and da 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 da. So she seems like – yeah, I agree. She seems like she believes it, or, you know, even if she doesn't believe it, she still wants to go off with him. And then if it turns out to be true, well, there you go. But
– well, she's at least of the mindset that
– he's not mad.
Well, exactly. She may not believe it, but she fully understands that at least he believes it. And that all of his actions are predicated upon that belief, whether it is actual or not. And that at some point he would leave her because he honestly believes that he won't age and he's not going to stick around because it would just be weird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So after the revelation, everyone filters out. They have their little say about what a rotten joke it was. And as Art and Linda are leaving... And this, I have to say, this is the other piece of dialogue that gets me. She says, Oldman. Oh, that's a joke on a
old man,
on your age. And then she leaves. And you think, I would have thought they would have caught that one way earlier in the episode.
I know. It was a little cheap.
But she walks out, and then Sandy and John go outside, say bye-bye to the people, forgetting that Will is still inside the house. And she's so old, man's that thing. And he says, yeah, you know, I've had a lot of, like, John Paley for Paleolithic and John Savage. And I was in Boston 60 years ago, and I was John Tea Party. And at that moment, Will comes out, and he realizes that's his father's name.
Yeah.
Who we learn left them when he was under the age of 10.
Yep.
And he doesn't, you know, he's like, no, can't be. And then, so John knows the game's up, and he's...
Now he's being really honest.
Did Nora get... or whatever her name was, did she get remarried?
Did she ever get remarried? And he says, yeah. And then Will says, I had a dog. What was his name? Wolfie.
Wolfie. And that was just the guy.
But then I think the real kicker is, you know, Will starts shivering, and John calls him Chilly Willy. So apparently that's something that has carried over since childhood.
And he remembers you had a beard, and because he's holding his face, like, I remember. I remember. And of course, we had that line earlier in the film, which we mentioned, where he says, I barely remember my dad.
You know, but we've also talked about how sometimes there are things that will just bring something right out of the deepest part of the memory up right to the very front, to the point where you could almost see it. And that's Will's moment. There are these little triggers.
Unfortunately.
But yeah, at a terrible cost.
At a terrible cost, because Will dies on the spot. A heart attack. So,
which was very telegraphed.
Yeah, it was telegraphed that he wasn't going to outlast his wife for long, for whatever reason.
Well, they kept talking about his heart condition.
His heart condition, and right. Well, he's an older guy, and it's usually, you can't have a heart condition if you're not going to die sometime later in the episode, but or in the story. But and then Sandy realizes this is the first time you've ever seen
one of your children die.
One of your adult children die.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's my question. Was he at that university to look in on his son? Did he know when he got there? Or was that just a...
Wow. That is a really good question. Now, John has said that there are times where, you know, every time, not every time, but sometimes when he has established new lives.
He pretends to be his own son.
Well, pretends to be his own son, but he apparently he goes through really good efforts to set the stage so that when he comes in, it's totally plausible, because he does talk about how one time when he did pretend to be his own son or something, and he got caught on it, and he was imprisoned in Belgium for 2 years.
Yeah, I don't know if that was when he was trying to be his son, but yeah, he got caught forging something or faking an identity, and yeah.
Right, so now he takes very careful steps. So anybody who does take those kind of careful steps, it would kind of suggest that maybe he knew...
Yeah,
that
well,
Will
I mean,
there?
There's no way that even if the second he walked into the room 10 years ago, 50-year-old Will sees him and says, wow, you're the spitting image of my dad. That's, you know, that is just never going to think you are my dad. Not going to happen, right?
Right.
I mean, your mind just is not going to process it that way. You're just going to go like, whoa, so...
You remind me of my dad.
Yeah, the chance of detection is zero.
Oh, absolutely zero.
There, so
I mean, I've seen a number of people that I've even said to their face, "You remind me of my father," but at no time did I ever think, "Hey, Dad, what are you doing here?" No, I've never done that, and so it is perfectly plausible. If indeed John was there to look in on his son. Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I mean, John is a good man. He's very compassionate. He cares about those that are around him. There's nothing to say that he didn't care about his own kid, and he just wanted to anonymously make sure that he was okay.
And another one of those things you catch on, or at least I caught on second go around, is there is a scene when Will is not in the room, I might add, where Dan says, we have too many short names in this thing. Says, you know, one of us, one of us in this room could be one of your descendants.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
He's, of course, thinking about, you know, a child that John had
way
a thousand
back.
Years ago.
Yeah, yeah, like, and yeah, that. And to be honest, that's exactly what I thought, that this was a child that John had, you know, a century or so ago, and through multiple generations, there is now a relation. And, nope, you know, and that's still possible. It's not outside the realms of possibility, but obviously that's not what Jerome Bixby had in mind.
Right. He's definitely his.
He's going for something more direct.
Well, you know, we know that supposedly 60% of the population of Asians in the world are descended from Genghis Khan. I don't know how they've worked that out, but
I didn't know that.
It's some crazy number like that, because he had, you know, thousands of concubines and kids with all of them. And
wow, so that's
huge gene pool of genetic markers that trace back to Genghis Khan.
So
John would be the same way.
I've heard that with the Mormon Church, that anybody who has a last name Young is a descendant of Brigham Young. Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Well, there's only the one Young.
Yeah. I guess.
We've never let another one in, so we just had that one guy, so if you're in that. Here's the final question. Like you said, I had two things in this film that I couldn't quite figure out. One was, what were they trying to tell us about the professor and the student relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And I say the only thing I can get there is that they're just demonstrating the age gap, kind of a thought, like, he's there with a kid. She's a quote-unquote adult, but she's a kid.
She's his student. Inappropriate.
It's inappropriate, but she's also a kid. And
yeah.
But everyone in that room is a kid compared to John Oldman.
True.
Everyone, every woman he's ever going to meet is 14,000 years younger than him.
Yes.
And so I have a feeling they're trying to do something. But the other one that – set that on the side, because I don't have an answer for that. The other one is –
I don't either.
Dan is driving down the road when the cops go by.
Oh, yeah.
And he stops and he looks. And my impression is that John's house is at the end of the road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fairly obvious the cops are going.
He's going to one place.
And he stops, and he thinks, and he doesn't turn around and go back.
No, he doesn't. I noticed that, too.
Wouldn't
you? I would have gone back in a heartbeat.
What does he think it is? What is it that he doesn't want to know?
To be honest, I could not figure that one out either. That one had me totally puzzled.
Is he worried that Will killed him? Is he worried that they're having him committed? Does he think maybe Will's dead? I don't know. I mean,
I don't know what he's thinking.
He ponders it for a second and then he doesn't go back. Like, I think what we're getting here is, I don't want to know. Not I don't want to know what happened, but I don't want to learn any more about this story. I'm going to leave it where it is.
Possibly. I don't know. You know, the one thought that I had, of course, you know, when Dan leaves, he's leaving under the idea that John made the whole thing up. And one of the thoughts that came to my head.
He does say at one point, though, I don't know, I still have a feeling about this, before he leaves, after he's doing the crying. So he's still half thinking it's...
Yeah, he's not completely disbelieving it.
That's right.
So, but, and I will admit, and I will freely admit that I think my initial gut impression is wrong. So I'm just going to say that. I don't believe that my analysis on this is correct. But the first thought that I had that came to my mind was that he thought maybe John was dead.
That crossed my mind too. Like, did Will do something there? Like, he threatened to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, okay, he took the gun away, and yes, he didn't have any bullets, but we don't actually know that he didn't have another gun and that he didn't have bullets and that, you know, they're left alone. One of them did something drastic. And
right.
Yes, it's, I agree that that's a very real possibility that he's concerned. You know, basically it's three things. I mean, Will's dead, John's dead, John's going to be put away.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are really probably not thinking something happened to Sandy in that case. And then the question is, does he think, you know, there's been a terrible accident, or Yeah, I don't know. I think he just doesn't want
closure. He just doesn't want closure. To know.
He doesn't want closure.
No.
Obviously, he goes back to work, and the next day he finds out that Will died, then of a heart attack, then there was nothing he could have done if he'd gone back, although he probably will think for the rest of his life that he could have. You know, maybe if I'd gone back quicker, he wouldn't have died.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda, if I'd done that, would Will still be alive? Yeah, I mean, it's that whole survivor's guilt thing.
Yeah. So, which, you know, Will did ask John about, do you have survivor's guilt? And no, he doesn't. another thing that he should, he probably shouldn't, but anyway, no. I am very pleased you enjoyed the film.
Like I said, there are very few movies, especially today. I mean, it was easier when I was, you know, younger in my teens and my 20s to walk out of a film and just be completely in love with it. It's very, very hard today for me to see something and just say, that is one of the greatest films I've ever watched. This is one of the greatest films I have ever watched. It is absolutely astonishing. And for me, it was not so much in the story that John had to tell, but it was in the reactions of everybody else who was in the room. Gauging their reactions, how they were absorbing everything John was saying. That's what I found compelling.
It's kind of interesting to go back to the Star Trek analogy. You do have, you know, the argument, and we've talked about it, that Spock is the logic and the rational reason.
Right, right.
McCoy is the heart. That those stories are constructed to put those characters in that place. This is clearly a deconstructed discussion. I mean, it's
absolutely
much more compartmentalized.
Oh, totally.
To do this.
And John even points that out when he quote unquote fesses up that the whole thing was just, you know, he was testing out a science fiction novel that he was going to be writing, and then he picks on every single one of these people. You know, this is Jerome Bixby's psyche that he has broken down. You know, all the different aspects to his life as, you know, as he's approaching the end of his. He understands that he's got these different personalities, not personalities, but these different thinking types in his brain, and he's breaking them down individually and creating an argument back and forth with each of these aspects. It's almost like Jerome Bixby trying, you know, he's grappling with his own concept of what immortality may or may not be. This is not the first time I've heard of somebody doing this.
Yeah, it feels so much like. So there's a saying that dialogue is what you would have said if you had 10 minutes to think about it, right? I mean, that's being Hawkeye Pierce on MASH and always having the witty comeback. There are very, very few people in this world that can do that. But if you're a writer and you have the room and the time, you can make a superhuman dialogue, if you will. And I feel like from the moment he wrote Requiem for Methuselah, he's probably been jotting notes down since that time.
It's very possible. At least
feels like this has had a lot of thought put into
it. Yeah, that's when he wrote Requiem, that's when he placed himself on the path, shall we say. And if he wasn't writing down notes, I'm fairly convinced that he was at least running it over in his brain. To what degree, who's to say, we may never ever know. But on some level, it was always percolating. Either in the front of his brain or the back of his brain, shall we say, until it came time for this story to be written.
Gone about it 35 years, I managed to condense it all down into a 90-minute conversation.
That's a nice little analogy.
You know, I mean, well, that's, you know, how you'd have to do it to get it to be a movie. I would love to see where Jerome Bixby's line and his son ended, because, as I say, it was dictated.
Yeah,
it was dictated to his son. So it's doubtful that this is an unadulterated Jerome Bixby work.
I suspect that this is as pure as it's going to get.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously had the ideas, and he may have, you know, whether he put them down in the same order, whether he had the, whether it was the discussion points, whether it was, we will never know. And, you know, to the credit of his son, he says his dad dictated it to him. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying it didn't come out of Jerome Bixby's mind. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, did Jerome Bixby go, act one, scene one?
Oh, no.
John is
that.
Like, no, he did
no,
not.
No. He
says,
did not
I
do
get
that.
This story. I get this guy. He's packing up to leave.
Yes.
And that's what I think. And I think his son turned it into the process, the screenplay that we see out of it. So
I agree.
It's, either way. Well, anyway. This is going to be a long one.
Oh, podcast. But it was a good one.
And so I hope our listeners got the chance to enjoy this. I hope you had a chance to watch the film. If you haven't watched the film, for crying out loud, go watch the film. It's one of a whole
what
bunch
are
of
you waiting
films.
For? This yeah. is one of the greatest science fiction films ever made.
Without space battles.
And it, yes, it goes to show that science fiction doesn't have to be this big sprawling space epic, that it can be something very intimate and minimalist and be even more profound.
I will say that I this time through, the family watched it with me, my wife enjoyed it and thought it was really good. Michelle enjoyed it. She, I think some of the ideas disturbed her. Yeah. I'm not sure which ones, because it's hard to get anything out of her because she's in her teenage meh days. But it's like, and then James sat through and watched the whole thing, and there were times when he'd go, "Oh, this is what we're learning about in our physical geography class," where he'd talk about migrating with the peoples and the stuff like that. But afterwards, he did say, "I didn't like that film." And I asked him why, and he says, "Well, nothing happened. They just all talked." And I'm like, all right, he's 11.
He's young.
He's 11 years old.
Right. Yeah. You know, give him a few years, and then have him see it again, and he may see this with fresh eyes.
So, Ben, thank you for joining me.
Oh, this was a pleasure.
Well, good. That'll make up for the next two Blake.
Yes,
Sevens
I know. And, thank you very much.
Space 1999. And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle at Fusion Patrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.